a new bunch of material. There was a question by email about which constants do not work. So to top and bottom, let me remind, are the additive constant and 0 and 1 are multiplicative constants. So top and bottom are the greatest elements. Top is the greatest element, bottom is the smallest element, and 0 and 1 are neutral elements respectively on the right and on the left. Is this clear or not quite? And the other question was whether you are allowed to use the structural rules absorbing the fact that on the classical logic part we are using this calculus which absorbs structural rules. I didn't remember myself having to use structural rules actually, but if you do need, yes, then we proved for that particular version of the calculus that the structural rules absorbing. So, so yes, in case you need it, which I can do, and you think you would, just quote the corresponding theorem from the lecture. So I hope this answers the question. Are there any other questions? Yes, so top was like a neutral element. Actually, you will see those guys again in action today apart from zero. So, but in a very different system. Playing the same role still. So top was a neutral element for, or like unit element for lattice me, for this additive conjunction. Bottom was neutral element for lattice joint, so for additive disjunction. One was, I don't disagree. I thought that this was dominant in the lecture, but fair enough. So,
like my mushroom. No. It's analog. Yes. I will put this online, but every now and then you may be tempted to actually make some notes. So I will, if I go too quickly, just warn me. I will try to be go at reasonable speed. But this will be just introductory part. I realized during the linear logic introduction that doing this kind of things on blackboard really leads to me having to talk a lot and write a lot, and you have to write longish quotes or bits of history, which is some. So the way I'm going to play it today, I'm going to give just the introduction on the slides, and then once we start to do some concrete, of course, the sequence system again, then I'm going to switch this off and we are going to do proper notes. So here, this is just for motivation, especially that I already have, as you may guess, partially ready slides for this. So I will reuse this, and then in the second half we will again start doing what we're always doing. So the next and last major system is once again a special case of substructural logic, sort of falls into the family of substructural logic. This time it's so-called logic of bunch implications. It was started, well, as you will see, we can trace these references, trace its origins quite a while back, but probably it is safe to say that it was first published as a complete system first described in papers by Peter O'Hearn and David Pym in the late 1990s. Papers were submitted in 1988 and published in 1999. The most canonical one is probably the one published in Bulletin of Symbolic Logic called The Logic of Bunch Implications. But at the time already David Pym was working or finishing, had a draft of monograph which was published in 2002, The Semantics and Proof Theory of the Logic of Bunch Implications. So there is already, there was very soon a whole book fed on this. And another paper that is going to be very useful reference for us as a source of examples, another material will be when Phil already started to stabilize a bit in 2004, Possible Worlds and Resources, The Semantics of BI by Pym, O'Hearn and Young. But I mean, other references, some of them you will see in subsequent slides. One thing that already should mention is that all these people were really inspired by very famous computer scientist who died in a recent period, John Reynolds, one of the founding fathers of some areas in theoretical computer science. So what is central in the logic of bunch implications, or rather in semantics, is the notion of resource. And this sounds already a bit similar, a bit familiar, right? Pym himself, David Pym, the author of this monograph on the logic of bunch implications, often quotes the definition of this notion from a book by Bridge Hansen, Monograph on Operating Systems, which, as he points out, is unusual among computer science books in that the author actually bothers to give rather well thought of definitions of what he's talking about. And the definition goes of the word resource goes as follows. It covers physical components, processes, procedures, and data structures. In short, anything that can be, any object that can be referenced by computation. And David Pym says that the word reference is crucial here. In particular, this means if you can reference something from one computation, can be also referenced, dereferenced, accessed by more than one computation. And the question is who is, for example, allowed to share this resource, and what changes is this process making to it. And well, I said that the word resource should be familiar because I already mentioned it in the context of linear logic, right? But indeed, one can write the whole paper, and in these early papers that I was quoting, there are always several pages comparing differences and similarities between the setup of linear logic and logic of bunch implications. But what we had in linear logic, what the way resources work there, they were tightly connected to number of uses interpretation. So if you remember, those things that were not preceded by bunch, they were used up. Right? They were like, the difference was like the difference between, on one hand, oil, coal, or all these things that we are going to burn sooner or later and we are going to be messed up, and things more like water and air that are, from the perspective of our lives at least, more or less in unlimited supply. So whenever, whatever was not preceded by bank, another analogy, by the way, if you remember, was that, or way of reading linear logic setup, was that whatever was preceded by bank was like an axiom, something, some information that is always a variable and can be reused, whereas things that are not preceded by it, can, they are really like those slots that you use in vending, the coin or tokens that you put in slots of vending machine, and once it's gone, it's gone. So this is not exactly what is meant here, right? I mean, and probably you can already see that this way of thinking of resources, what you see here in this definition, is closer to what you're interested in most often as computer scientists. We are not really, we're hardly ever using up those resources physically. Information stored somewhere in memory remains stored in memory after you read out from it. Another process can still read out. We have slightly different bunch of problems to look at. We will see very soon what kind of problems arise and why it's important, why it's useful to have a formalism which allows us to reason about world of resources in this sense. And as it turns out, logic of bunch implication also will have quite different formal properties to those of linear logic. So this interpretation is central, as I already suggested, to the success story of BI in CS. The paper which probably laid foundation for this success story, apart of course from Romoldi's paper, is that simply gave us the logic of bunch implication as a system with its own proof, calculus, natural deduction, sequence system, and semantics, was a paper by Ishtag and O'Hearn, the logic of bunch implication as assertion language for mutable data structures. We will see the definition of what mutable data structures are in a few minutes. So what this paper presented, what this paper offered, was a perspective on the logic of bunch implication as a assertional core for Hoare logic, which was promoted by John Reynolds for reasoning about shared mutable data structures. Who has seen here the notion of Hoare triple? Who has not? Be honest. Who is not quite sure whether, because some people were raising their hands like this, so it wasn't clear for me whether you completely have not seen it or have seen it somewhere, but not quite remember what this all was about. This of course, is a bit problematic for one or two examples I'm going to give, but the important part of presentation where we're going to start to develop syntax and, of course, semantics is completely irrelevant. So if some of the examples are not very understandable for you, simply bear with. So this formalism, this Hoare logic, the system for reasoning about shared mutable data structure, became widely known as separation logic, and now we will spend quite a few slides on motivation for it. So we already gave the definition of resource from this old book by Bridge Hansen. We can also define what a shared mutable data structure is. This is a structure when an updatable field can be referenced from more than one point of, well, point is probably not very good term, and this is not such a good definition as the one of resource that we have seen two or three slides before. From more than one computation or from more than one process would be more adequate. Examples of such data structures are lists, single node doubly linked queues, trees, stacks, and so on and so on. So everything that makes our everyday coding, especially languages like C, so much fun and so much mess. And you know what kind of issues that arise with pointers, heaps, allocation, and so on and so on. So it's a subject of immense significance, but also a major source of errors, issues, bugs like dangling pointers, memory leaks, segmentation faults, and again, all this fun that we normally have. So where does the pain come from? Well, I already suggested that these programs are not really difficult to reason about, and Peter O'Hearn, one of the people behind, main people behind logic of partial implication and also separation logic, gave, he likes to give several examples, especially at the time when he was still trying to make this formalism popular in the early 2000s, he was comparing it to the state of the art at that time. So, of course, this example is more than 15 years old, but how the situation used to look like before people came up with good, well thought of formalisms to address this particular issue of reasoning about Chermitable data structure. We had already some very powerful tools. Some of them were promoted by Microsoft, and Bill Gates was so proud of them that he even mentioned it in his keynote address in 2002. This was SLAM protocol, which was used to reason about properties of procedure calls in device drivers. But there were more serious things, like, for example, static analyzer Astre, which the very name suggests that it's French stuff, which proved completely automatically absence of any runtime errors in the primary flight control software of the Airbus. Well, that was rather old model of Airbus, but since then they were successful in handling also more new or more complicated Airbuses. But even those projects, which were already very serious industrial things, were still in need of automatic heap verification. First of them assumed that we have memory safety in general, without saying how you are going to go there. And the second assumed that we have no dynamic pointer allocation, which again simplifies this kind of things quite a bit. But so why people were resorting to such assumptions rather than addressing the issue head on? One of the papers by funding by the authors who gave us separation logic and logical partial implications has it as follows: that the difficulty is not in finding in principle adequate operation of pointer operations. It's just that there is a mismatch between simple intuitions. I mean, if you're a programmer, especially if you had to suffer through several months of programming in C or in other colors, you know more or less what is happening, well, more or less as witnessed by all the errors that I was talking about, and the complexity of axiomatic treatments that it requires. Pointer assignment in itself is operationally simple, but when you have aliasing arising from several pointers to a given cell, then an alteration to the cell may affect the values of many syntactically unrelated expressions. And here is one piece of code, or rather pseudocode, to make it easier to read, whether your preferred language is C or not, whose idea is to append list to another list. So now we're thinking of a model of memory, extremely simplistic one, in fact, where you have memory cells, which such that one is storing actual value, and another pointer to another memory cell, which is again of the same form. Right? This is our linked list. And in particular, this is what where our linked lists will live, and linked lists themselves should finish at some point into neither. Right? But we have this special type of pointer. So we are passing two pointers to memory cells to such a procedure with the idea that will have to be somehow expressed by the contract that one of those pointers is to head of one list X and another is to another list Y. Using two local auxiliary variables, which will store some additional pointers, we iterate through the first of those lists. Right? So let's assume that this is my x and this is my y. And there will be fragments of memory which will be shaped in a very bad way, such that they cannot really be thought of as list at all. For example, if you have Cyprus. This is not a list, right, in any meaningful sense. So let's assume, let's hope, again, this will have to be ensured by the contract that X and Y are pointing to what they should. So the idea is then that you start with setting, well, if the X itself is nil, then appending the list reference to by X, appending the list reference to by Y to the list reference by X is very simple. You simply say that the new list is the one starting with Y itself. Miriam, what's up? Any questions? I mean, especially you should not have any questions, but so otherwise, if X, this was X, this was Y. If X is not, X is not an empty list, what we do is to iterate through this list using these auxiliary pointers. So first we start with T being the head of the list, and then we use U to reference what was stored by the next pointer. Is this thing empty? Is this nil pointer? If not, well, then this is our new T and this is new U. And okay, we reached nil. So this is where we will attach now. Right, so now we have a list which consists of two older ones. This is very, very trivial. I mean, if you were forced to suffer through programming with C, you know that this is at the very, very early level of all the mess you have to go through. But let's see what kind of things arise even when you try to completely specify, describe, or reason about what's going on here. So assume that our assertion language contains a predicate list which precisely says that you don't have a situation like this, right? That the sequence of pointers starting from X is indeed a well-formed list with something which does not end in a cycle but simply goes all the way to nil. First of all, this is the predicate for list. We start with more general predicate saying that we have a well-formed list segment, simply something which does not end in a cycle. And then from X, from the cell reference to X to the cell reference by T. So then the question is, and then this is only a question to those of you who know what a valid Hort triple is, if this thing is valid. So if we know that X is a pointer to well-formed list, and Y is a pointer to a list, is it true that after we run this procedure, what starts at X will be again a well-formed list? So something which will not end in the lasso like this. Or it will not be a cycle in its own right. Yes?
It is not true because the predicate doesn't talk about the list in the path from X to nil and from Y to nil. So if, for example, the last element of Y and the last element of X is the same, we create a cycle.
Yes. We have no guarantee that X and Y occupy distant areas of memory. So we will have to first say that X itself cannot be a sublist of Y. So we don't have we, for example, have to exclude such a situation. I'm drawing it in a very simplistic way now. Because then if we had something like this, then we will end up so if this is maybe let's be more explicit. or simply, if this is X and this is Y from the very beginning, then we'll end up forming something like this. Similarly, if Y is a sublist of, sorry, this was a solution where Y was sublist of X, and something similar, lasso would appear if X was a sublist of Y. But it could also happen, as it was pointed out, that even if they are not contained one in the other, we have a situation like this. So both of them are perfectly fine lists in its own right. But but the last segment of them overlaps, and then you create something like this. So again, you obtain something like a lasso. I'm not sure what is even the right name in it for it in standard handbooks, monographs, memory models, whatever. So you have to ensure, as I said, that you live in that these two guys live that not just X and Y itself, but the whole sequence of cells that can be accessed following pointers from it live in this general area of memory. And also, if you know how to do reasoning with using Hoar logic, you have to transfer such assumptions through all possible loop invariants. And you also have not just to be able to state this information, but to reason about, decide, and infer such assertions. And then, of course, this is a very trivial piece of code. It's hardly ever worth considering as a program in its own right. So you'd like then this procedure to be a fragment of larger program. And you remember who has seen here the notion of design by contract. So precondition, postconditions, okay, less than a half. So the very idea is that when you do reasoning, Hoare-based reasoning about a program which contains procedure, that the only thing you know about the procedure from the point of view of program verification and specification is what is state as precondition and postcondition as this procedure. So it's the job of the program to ensure that precondition of a given procedure holds when you're calling it, and then the procedure simply tells you that the postcondition is true. And that's all that you know, right? We don't know anything else about how the procedure is doing its stuff. So we can have such piece of code as a fragment of much larger program reasoning about some complicated data structures, some very large heaps. And when such a procedure happens, is invoked, the Floyd-Hoare reasoning can only use information that is in the contract, the precondition and postcondition. And then, in order to keep up with this reasoning, we have to be able to infer that nothing outside the area occupied by, not by X itself, but the whole list started from X changed. And that if you merge it with some, if you then use this list together with some other list, which is occupying some different area of memory, some funny things do not happen. And this is what is known, not only in computer science, but even in artificial intelligence, and for quite a long time, since late 1960s, as the frame problem. This was probably first introduced by people who were already on the borderline of philosophy and artificial intelligence and computer science, McCarthy and Hayes, in a paper from 1969. And this kind of issues arise not only when you reason about least resources and shortmutable data structures. If you try to write a simple agent living in our ordinary world, which has to do some ordinary task that we are doing on everyday basis, for example, that we can get into conversation with somebody else by looking up this somebody else number in phone book and dialing it up. Whichever formalization you're going to write, say in Lisp, because, well, McCarthy was the guy behind Lisp, maybe this was his favorite tool to do artificial intelligence. it is almost certain that in the end you will miss some hypotheses, like if a person has a telephone, he or she still has it after looking up a number in the telephone book. Or if you look up phone number in the book, then you will know it. And then, of course, there will be all sorts of special case scenarios that we better be able to exclude, like that the page with this guy phone number may be torn out. The guy who wants to make the phone call may be visually impaired. Somebody may have deliberately inked out the number of this guy from the phone book. The telephone company have made the entry incorrectly, or the guy may have got the phone only recently. Or the whole phone system may be out of order. Or the guy to whom you want to make a call could have passed out. I mean, all these things are extremely detailed scenarios, but you know, we always have to take these kind of things into account, whichever ordinary everyday action you do, whenever you are calling your friend or your partner to make an appointment, even for evening dinner. And again, even simple artificial intelligence program and system should be able to cope with this kind of issues. And this means that when you formally describe a change in the system, you have to specify which part of the state are not affected by this by the change. And you know, it's much it's much harder to say which things are not affected, because you know where it is large and things are connected in it, than what is immediately affected by it. So this was in artificial intelligence, but very soon, well, not very soon, actually, the paper that I'm quoting here is more than a quarter of a century later than the original work of McCarthy and Hayes. It was also realized when people were trying to reason or discuss formal specifications using, again, this Floyd horologic of object-oriented code. And when you run into things like inheritance issues between classes and stuff like this. And all these horror-style formalisms to invented in last, say, 20 years or so for shared mutable data structure use the term frame very prominently, and it's precisely frame we've taken from this work of McCarthy and Harris. In particular, the separation logic, which is our main interest, or as I said, rather, it's assertional core, which is bunch implication logic. A central core rule is called the frame rule. And a system where you have this kind of rule, I will show you in one or two slides how exactly this thing looks like, turn out to be useful not just in the context of resources understood as heaps and pointers, but also in the context of concurrency. So this notion of resource that we have seen defined in the second slide from the monograph of Bridge Hansen, where you remember the word resource was taken very, very broadly, is applicable in all this. Whenever such a notion is applicable, we can do some form of bunch implication logic, as it turns out. There were also alternative approaches which are not relying on this substructural logics like formalism, like dynamic frames. Again, it's not coincidence that the name frame appears in the very names of this approach. But even in that particular case, it was turned out later that it made sense to merge it, at least partially, with some formal features and insight coming from separation logic. In particular, the one connective that I'm going to talk about right now. So what is the central idea of this separation logic and its underlying assertional language of bunch implication logic? Let's say that we're talking in particular about memory models, and when we want to reason about heap. Well, rather than trying to desperately think about what is going on everywhere in the whole global heap, in the whole memory of the system when writing and reading specifications, you should think of heaplets, small portions of the heap, which are logically, if not physically, disjoint. So So then when you write a whole triple like this, you mean that if these are two assertions written in the language of bunch implication logic or is extension, and this is actual code of a program. So what it really says is that if your piece of code is given a heaplet satisfying P, then it will never try to access heap outside of P, apart possibly from cells allocated during the execution. And it will deliver a heaplet satisfying Q if it terminates. And of course, this will have implications for how C acts on the global heap of what we can say or which information we can use in our resolving. And then assertions about disjoint parts of memory, like something that we wanted to have before, are combined using a connective which is called spatial conjunction, which can be also known called separating conjunction or independent conjunction. But as you can probably see or guess from subsection logic point of view, it's a special case of fusion or multiplicative conjunction, even if it's somewhat different in its formal properties than what we have seen in linear logic. The main idea is the same. Reynolds himself, the guy who was founding father of separation logic, was less inspired maybe by substructural logic, chronoclassical logic, and more by early work by Rothbarstall on some techniques on proving correctness of programs which alter data structure. But all the other people, O'Hearn, Pym, and so on, they were very well versed in substructural logics, as it were. So, if you recall our piece of code that I'm not quoting here again, and this whole triple that we wanted to be valid, and the problem we had with that, if you had such a separating conjunction, things are looking much better. Because now what you are saying is that the outset, before you start running this procedure, append list, these two guys are living in disjoint parts of memory. It's precisely the kind of thing that we were missing in order to make that triple valid. And the frame rule that I was announcing would be that if you have a piece of code which, given a heaplet satisfying A, will deliver a heaplet satisfying B, and then when you have another assertion or predicate in the language of bunch implication logic, but where no variable used in that predicate is touched in any way by the code C, then if you have a heaplet which can be divided into two disjoint parts, one satisfying A and another satisfying this A prime, after you run this piece of code C, it will deliver a heaplet which will satisfy B. So this is really where this code is working, and this part will be simply ignored. And the logic of bunch implication has also other connectives, like what they called magic wand. But this is precisely the multiplicative implication in the bunch implication setting. What they are using it for in such formalism is to derive weakest preconditions. And as a rule, in fact, not just in this special setup of logic of bunch implication, one is using some form of implication in deriving weakest preconditions, even if you're doing very ordinary reasoning about imperative programs. But unlike linear logic, because we did have multiplicative implication as in linear logic setting, we were just writing it like as a lollipop rather than magic wand, we also have additive implication, which will be precisely the implication of intuitionistic logic. we could, and this was not very, very well highlighted by the exercises. Instead, we had this whole mess with translating classical logic into linear logic. We could somehow reconstruct ordinary additive implication, which would be, as mathematicians would say, adjoint to this additive conjunction. We could reconstruct it in the linear logic setting like this. Well, we had additional technical difficulty, which also led me not to put this kind of thing on the previous blad, that if we wanted to reconstruct linear logic rather than classical logic as a intuitionistic logic rather than classical logic as a part of linear logic, we have this involutive negation in the classical linear logic setting. There is a weaker subsystem called intuitionistic linear logic, and then this translation works very smoothly. It actually works also when translating intuitionistic logic into classical linear logic, but then the proof requires some proof theoretical subtleties. And I thought that would be much easier. I'm sorry that it didn't really work like this, to do translation of classical logic into linear logic, and then we will not run into all sorts of problems. But here we have the additive implication natively, as related in the same way to additive conjunction as the lollipop, or in this case magic wand, is related to the multiplicative conjunction. So now we have more or less complete picture, which we can start developing, turning into proper proof system. Our logic of bunch implication combines in intuitionistic logic for additive connectives with multiplicative connectives that we know already from linear logic, which are where multiplicative conjunction is commutative, but that's about it. It doesn't satisfy weakening, it doesn't satisfy contraction. Note that we don't, I'm deliberately not putting zero here, the multiplicative bottom or falsity, or multiplicative disjunction. And this is not a coincidence or oversight. It would be possible to combine the logic of bunch implication with classical linear logic. Indeed, this was done, but this is much more recent development. And it was already living under different names and in different disguises, for example, in fragments of relational algebras and relevant logic in the past. But this would kill the most intended semantics in terms of those heaps and heaplets that we wanted to have. It has some other interesting observation interpretation, but not the one that people really care about when you do logical bunch implication. So now I could give you a very straightforward definition if we were working, let's say, in terms of category theory from the very beginning. I will simply say that the logic of bunch implication is the logic of bi-Cartesian doubly closed categories, which are combining two monoidal closed structures, one of which is bi-Cartesian. Fine enough. Or if you had algebra, at least, forget about category theory, then I would simply say, oh, this is just the logic of Heiting algebras equipped with additional structure of residuated commutative monoid, which we could call then BA algebras. And that would be it, right? I would finish the definition. But I don't have those resources on my hand. We're not doing category theory algebra, so we have to define what BI is proof theoretically. And of course, I have to give you some kind of Kripke semantics, in this case, in form of preordered resource monoids. We'll start, though, with syntactic proof theoretical approach, just like linear logic case. But there would be some difficulties. We have already learned, I'm not sure if this was well, if this came across well and clear, or if it was remembered from the first lecture when I was introducing linear logic, but having additive implication, not encoded somehow like this, but natively as tightly closed in this adjoint kind of way, whatever this adjointness means, we will see it in one slide or two, to additive conjunction, forces that we have distributivity laws for those two connectives, for those relative connectives, for additive conjunction and disjunction. We will be able to derive this formally in the proof system that we are going to see soon. But it has to be somehow reflected without collapsing the multiplicative connectives. But even more fundamentally and basically, how do we distinguish introduction rule for multiplicative and additive implication if it's supposed to be straightforward introduction rule? Well, the solution was found by in proof theory of Ilie substructural logic, where the additive connectives were also distributive. Well, the idea was that if comma on the left side of the sequence arrow is playing the role of multiplicative conjunction, why don't we introduce another symbol, let's say semicolon rather than comma, which will play the same role with respect to additive conjunction. Then we will have our desired two different introduction rules that we wanted so much. If you want to introduce the multiplicative implication or the magic wand, well, this is the rule that we have already seen. If you want to introduce, and then this comma will only be commutative within its own part of a what is on the left-hand side of the sequence, but that's about it. Or if you want to introduce an additive implication, you have to have a sequence shaped like this, whose principal meta-connective is this semicolon. Well, is this really, and then the semicolon should somehow satisfy weakening and contraction. What does it really mean? What kind of solution it is? If you complicate the setup like this, this means that the left side of sequence arrow is no longer just a list or a multiset even. It's another special tree. Namely, it's a tree whose internal nodes are labeled with semicolons and commas. So if I write if I write something like this, well, this means that I'm having a tree here where the root is labeled by comma and one of the child is alpha. Then the other child is an internal node whose, maybe let me put everything on the slide. Whose label is semicolon, and well, here they have a leaf with this actual formula, which again may have all sorts of things, additive, multiplicative connectives, but this is already a formula, right? These things are not parts of formulas themselves. This is what a sequence, and sorry, not the sequence even. This is what just the left-hand side of the sequence is. And such special kind of trees were known to another tribe of substructural logicians, as I was saying, relevant logicians, under the name of punches. And this is exactly when the name of the logic of punch implication comes from. And this also means that even empty antecedents of this sequence arrow must get split into things which are empty in the multiplicative way and things which are empty in the additive way. So we can write, let's say, empty set prefixed with multiplicative and additive connective. Multiplicative and additive subscript. The first of them, just like this thing was metalinguistic counterpart of additive conjunction or lattice conjunction, and this thing was metalinguistic cuisine of multiplicative conjunction. This guy will encode on the meta level one, and this guy will encode on meta level top. And you are already having this look on your faces, which also suggests that we reached this stage when the styles are no longer useful. So we went through a long list of examples, quotes, references. But now it would be good to take things slowly and start defining things properly. So we will switch off the slides and get Blackboard dirty. So first, let us define what was already shown on the slides, but let's write it as a proper grammar of formulas. And let us recall we are doing introduction to the logic of bunched implications, BI, and separation logic too, but formulas. And once again, I'm going to try to stick to phi, psi, and chi, but sometimes maybe alphas, betas, and whatnot, whenever it's convenient. So we had items again. We had additive and multiplicative truth and false constant. Additive truth and additive false. And we have multiplicative unit, but not bottom. This is what we said. And we can form conjunction, disjunction, implication additively, but we can also do stuff multiplicative. These are formulas. Now I have to define the notion of a bunch. So something which would be allowed to appear on the left-hand side of the sequence. A bunch can be empty in the multiplicative way, or it can be empty in the additive way. But you always have to say in which way, even if you want it to be empty. Otherwise, well, it can simply consist of a single formula. Or if you want to combine two bunches, you either do it writing a comma between them, which is multiplicative combination of bunches, or you do it writing semicolon between them, which is additive combination of bunches. Was there any special name for it? And now, these kind of things, as we have already seen, are trees. And we can then say that delta is subbunch of gamma if it appears in gamma as labeled subtree. We can also give rather obvious definition what it is to be a bunch with a hole in it. We could write a formal Kramer definition, but it hardly makes sense. Well, it makes sense, but I'm not sure if it's really necessary. So, it is possible to, let's say, for example, here in this example, forget about one of the subformulas, and then this place is ready to any bunch, any other bunch that we want to be plugged in into this tree as a sub-bunch. A formal definition, which I don't want to write so that you don't write too many grammars in the notes, would consist simply of adding a hole as Yermor construct and then saying that only one hole can appear in a bunch with hole. And then we will have to formally define what it means to be, what it means to have gamma delta, and actually, what is the right way of saying this, so we don't have to say too much. Gamma with delta substituted, or gamma with input delta, or simply gamma with hole filled with delta. We can also replace such a sub-bunch by another sub-bunch. So now, having all these auxiliary notions, we can define equivalence relation on those bunches. The equivalence relation is called, actually, what was the name that we're using? Coherent equivalence. I'm not really sure if I like this name, but this is an equivalence relation defined by by three conditions. Commutative monoid laws . Does everybody here remember what commutative monoid is? Who does not? Okay, everybody remembers. This means that this thing is unit of this commutative monoid. We also have commutative monoid laws for, you guess it, comma and this guy. And then we have congruence law. Maybe let's write again the name of this thing, coherent congruence. Well, as you can guess from the very use of the word congruence, this means that if you have two sub-bunches which are equivalent modulo this coherent equivalence, we can replace them in any larger, we can replace one by the other in any bunch, and we will obtain equivalent bunches again. And now, finally, we can say what, actually, we didn't even need this, all this to say what the sequence are. It was enough to have the definition of formulas and bunches. So sequence are of the form a bunch, sequence arrow, maybe let's write phi and psi, sequence arrow formula. Notice that we are here dealing with single conclusion system, because B, the base BI is intuitionistic thing, and it's in almost all of it would be probably possible to tweak this system into multiple conclusion the way we have seen it with sequence system for intuitionistic logic, but in most references this is single conclusion because this is more typical in the intuitionistic setup anyway. So without further ado, let me give you the rules, and there will be quite a few of them. But there will be also a lot of symmetry. Actually, maybe let's already start using this blackboard. So we have axiom rules. We have axiom rule. And now we are doing it not just for atoms, but for arbitrary formulas, although probably we could just state it for atoms and then do a long, complicated inductive proof saying that for all the other formulas it goes true. And we do have cut. And now cut, just like all the other rules, will be formulated in terms of this sub-bunches substitution. Well, it will not use congruences, but we will also see rules which do use congruences as well. So if you have a bunch, if you can prove that bunch sequence arrow phi, and then when you have another bunch that with phi, this phi as a leaf, or rather where the hole was filled in with phi turning into a leaf, then the CAD rule says that you could just as well fill this hole not just with a single formula turning into a leaf, but the whole bunch that you have here, so add a more complicated subtree, and you obtain, again, something entailing psi. This is the first family of those axioms, sort of those rules known by identities. Then we have a bunch of rules for units, and now I really probably start writing on new blackboard. And then we have to characterize again both additive and multiplicative units. Fortunately, these are rather the axioms that one would expect. So for top on the left, we say that actually, let me make sure that I don't miss any sub-bunch and any hole. Okay. We need to tight somehow the empty thing. Remember that this thing will be probably made to appear somehow using these monoid laws and rules governing congruences. So whenever you can show that a rule where one of the leaves is labeled with this additively empty set, you could instead plug a proper formula into this bunch. And this formula will be top. But on the other hand, you don't need any thing, just additive emptiness in order to get top. So these are the left and right rules. And as you can imagine, and this is actually quite cool because it's very, very symmetric compared to, in this particular aspect, compared to linear logic. Classical linear logic had some other symmetries that we are not seeing here, but. In a very analogous way, we can characterize what, yes? Anything messed up or unclear or?
No. I was wondering if we have the rule on the right side, if the empty set is an empty set and twice the top, and we use cut, if that already gives us the rule, but it's on the top.
If we can derive some of those rules with from others with cut,
yeah,
that would be surprising, but we will have to look at this. So you believe that this rule should be derivable from this rule with cut?
No, the other way around.
If you have this rule, can you somehow derive this rule with cut?
Yeah.
Well, we first have to say some for... Wait. How is this supposed to happen?
The other way around.
Maybe let's finish giving all the rules in the system, and then we can start to think what kind of things are derivable or not. In particular, we still need to have some rule which is governing somehow those equivalent bunches. So maybe let's just finish the obvious information that just like the additive emptiness give us top, then multiplicative emptiness give us one. And then we have to have poor lonely rule for additive. Can I still use part of this blackboard? Not really. For additive bottom, or for additive falsity, which is bottom, sorry, which is saying that simply whenever this guy is occurring anywhere in your leaves, then a bunch which has such a leaf can be used to derive anything. Again, as you recall, we don't have multiplicative zero here, so we don't have a symmetric rule on the multiplicative side. These were units. Just to make sure I'm on the right page. Now we have to characterize structural rules for multiplicative connectives, structural rules for additive connectives, and the multiplicative and the additive connectives themselves. Maybe let's start from implication. Actually, this does not seem the right order. Implication is a bit too messy. Yes, first let's do structural. And now there will be quite some asymmetry here because we want we want the all the structural rules for additive connectives. So correspondingly, we have to have them for what is corresponding on the meta level to them. So this is what contraction is. But we also have weakening. And this is also where we see the one rule, but rule that will be used over and over, as you can maybe already guess, and we'll very soon convince ourselves of, where we use this coherent equivalence. So if we have that the bunch gamma entails phi, this bunch gamma is coherently equivalent to delta, then delta is also giving us phi. Why this is called the structural rule? Well, observe that it gives us commutativity, ability to reorder within on the same level of the tree at least, for both additive and multiplicative connectives, because coherent equivalence rows incorporate commutative monadoid rows. But so far, I'm only talking about the things that are corresponding to connectives on the metalinguistic level. And it's crucial that I tell you now how to do similar things as we were doing here for empty sets and corresponding constants in the language for more complicated connectives, for the binary connectives. How do you go back and forth between semicolon and multiplicative and additive conjunction, and how do you go back and forth between colon and multiplicative conjunction in particular? So this will be precisely what introduction rules for those guys will be. So this is the most conventional sequence part. And let me reorder a bit what I have here in the notes. So if you have as a sub-bunch a tree whose root or the inner node is comma and the two leaves are phi and psi, giving us chi. This is where you can introduce, turn this whole subtree into a single formula, introducing the multiplicative conjunction. And we will have a rule for, actually here I can use phi and psi again. Putting things together in multiplicative way, which would be precisely the one that we remember from, sorry, these are multiplicative non-additives. This is what happens when you try to reorder your nodes on the fly. So now you can put these two bunches together using our comma, and then you put the right-hand side of the two sequence together using fusion, separating conjunction, or simply the, or spatial conjunction, or simply multiplicative conjunction. For implication, this is always a bit more fun. Well, the introduction rule we have already seen. So if you have a bunch whose root is a comma, then you can use it to introduce the magic wand on the right. It's a bit more mess when you want to introduce the introduce it on the left, although the rule is of the shape that is familiar from a generalization of a shape which is familiar from previous sequences that we had. So if this bunch enters phi and bunch delta, which as a sub-bunch in some inner node, as a root of this sub-bunch has comma and delta phi is one leaf on one side, and then on the other side we have yet another sub-bunch delta prime, then we can also derive that if we replace this thing but by gamma and wait, I still may need, yeah, I'm not having enough connectives. It should not be the same phi, of course. So this is some phi, this is another formula psi, and this is another formula chi. So now, if I replace the single leaf psi with bunch, with a sub-bunch whose root is comma, and then on the left-hand side we have gamma, and on the other side we have that, you can multiplicatively produce psi from phi, then you have phi. So these are the rules for multiplicatives, and the rules for additives will be symmetric. Huh? So the main difference, now I will write everything replacing commas with semicolons and spatial or separating conjunction or fusion with additive conjunction or lattice meet. And magic one with ordinary implication, really the most important difference between those between additive and multiplicatives is that we have this contraction becoming only for semicolons, right? Apart from this, this is plain sailing. So the rules for additives are Now, of course, you remember that we had difference between those G1 and G3 style think rules sequence when we wanted to have structural rules. Systems where we could have structural rules absorbing and explicit structural rules. And for parts with additives and semicolon, we will be able to derive similar formulation as a theorem, but I'm sticking here to the presentation that of LBI, the sequence system for branch implication, as you see in the original reference. And as we have already seen in the slides, we have entirely analogous right introduction rule for additive implication, and then we will also have analogous introduction rule for left, for additive implication on the left. But now everything will be written in terms of semicolon. Yes, of course. Well, then the other asymmetry, though less important than this asymmetry that we have between additives and multiplicatives, is that we have more connectives on the additive side. So I also need to characterize disjunction. Again, the left rule for disjunction, as usual, is more messy than the right rule. But the right rule is easy peasy. It's just that we again need to split it into two obvious copies. So the first one, the left version of the right introduction rule for this function, and I have not missed anything. Well, I could try to state at least one or two meta-theorems, but it hardly makes sense at this time, so let's leave you with this beauty to digest it, and tomorrow we'll start to play around with it. Tomorrow we will see several characterizations or reformulations of derivable sequence. We will see some of the structure of several reformulations in the spirit that we have seen before of rules for especially additive connectives, and we will hopefully start to talk about semantics in terms of this resource monoids and its most important instances, and maybe even prove soundness if we are so lucky. For the time being, well, you can already try to play around with it on your own and find a way around. And tomorrow everything should be clearer. So see you in 26 hours, 24 hours actually.